Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. We're at the last of April, aren't we, Ted? This is it.
This is it, yes.
Okay.
May Day, right. Tomorrow.
There we go. Yes. Does that mean... What does that mean? It means Vladimir Putin runs all his missiles in front of Moscow, Red Square or something.
Or get your baskets ready. That might
okay,
be
all right. Well, let's go with that. That's a little more positive. So thank you. I always appreciate your perspective. Ted brings us all the great the bumpers and the encouragement here today. By the way, if you're looking for something to see coming up here in a week or so, it's on the 8th of May, new movie out called Noble, and there's actually a campaign going along with it called She is Noble. It's about the nominating women that are really making a difference in the people's lives. You can find out more. We've got a couple links on our website, on our show page, Connecting Faith. But we do have some tickets. For those in the Twin Cities area, we do have some free tickets to give away to this this movie coming out on the 8th and showing in Maple Grove. And so you can sign up on our website. Go to myfaithradio.com. And click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's a little highlight right there about Noble.
Easy to find. It's under the Programs tab, just Connecting Faith, right under the Programs tab there. So.
And a pretty amazing story. You can watch the trailer there and see a little bit about this woman who had an amazing impact in Vietnam, caring for exploited children and stuff. So check it out. Got some tickets available. You can get some free tickets if you're looking for something to do here in a week or so. Got your May plans. You
can sounds good. So, sounds right. good. You have a timely interview today with everything happening in Baltimore.
I think so, yes. Our guest, we've had him on. It's been maybe a year or so since we've last talked with Byron Johnson. But he has done some amazing research and continues to research on issues of faith and life, which is so fitting here on Connecting Faith, because what we really are about, not just on this program, but really about Faith Radio in general, is to connect faith to life. How do we apply biblical principles to real-life situations? And we'll get some perspective today from Byron Johnson, who's the director of the Institute for Studies of Religion and a distinguished professor of social sciences at Baylor University. And he directs their program on pro-social behavior as well. And he's written an insightful book, which we have some copies of. This would be a resource that you would want to have or maybe pass on to someone who is involved in particularly ministries related to prison or maybe working with youth in urban areas or really anywhere. But the book is called More God, Less Crime. The subtitle is Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And we're just grateful to have Byron back on with us. And he's we're talking to him actually from South Africa. He's in a conference in South Africa. So good evening, Byron. Great to have you listening.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be back with you.
This topic, as Ted and I were just talking, is certainly appropriate, timely, because when it comes to pro-social behavior, we've seen some pretty anti-social behavior as it relates to, sort of triggered by crime and then police reaction and now riots in Baltimore. And so we'll maybe talk a bit about that as we go on. But I'm wondering first, maybe just to set up the premise for the book, that, you know, we kind of live in a climate, it seems like there's a maybe growing anti-religion and public life sort of sentiment. So is there any hopes of sort of expanding the discussion, the value of religious-based programs, whether they're preventative or in prisons or rehab or any of those things? Just maybe talk about why you wrote the book.
Sure. Well, you know, I wrote the book because there's so much now mounting evidence to show that these faith-based organizations, these people of compassion that dedicate so many hours, often unnoticed, trying to do good work. And their story doesn't get told very often in scientific journals. And because our journals are written in a way that, you know, they're good for putting people to sleep at night. That's about it. They're kind of hard to read. And so I wanted to do something that would help everyday people know that there's this mounting body of evidence that faith matters, that these faith-based organizations that do so much volunteer work really are beginning to make a difference. And in the book, as you rightly point out, that there is resistance oftentimes to these kinds of efforts, and at times it's really overt. But we're in a new day, and so my answer is going to be a little bit kind of complicated. One, I think that, you know, there is still prejudice against religion and religious organizations. I call it the last acceptable prejudice that's still out there. So there's this hostility, and I think there's a loss of religious freedom in America that's very concerning. But at the same time, we're in real trouble. We're looking for solutions. Most states don't have the money to continue to pour into criminal justice. And so they're looking for alternatives. They're looking for new answers. They're looking for innovation. And all the, many of the newest innovative creative programs that are beginning to show that they're effective and they don't cost anything are these faith-based programs. And because politicians and policymakers and, you know, government leaders recognize that they have to address problems, I'm actually seeing a new openness that hasn't been there before. And so, you know, states are encouraging instead of discouraging these people to come in and help them. And if it's a jobs program for prisoners, if it's a reentry program, or if it's a drug treatment program, whatever it might be, even in spite of the misunderstanding that people have about the faith community. They think that the faith community is only about evangelism, and they don't really understand all the good work that the faith community does in this country and all the philanthropy that comes from the faith community, and the responses to national disasters are largely undergirded by the faith community. But people in government that, you know, have to pay the bills, they do recognize some of this. And so I'm seeing new openness that hasn't been there before to faith-based approaches to social problems. And to that to me is encouraging if you look at, you know, a timeline of the last 20 years or so.
Byron, I know that I think maybe last time we talked, and your book does spend a good deal of time on programs, as you've talked about, things like the the work of Prison Fellowship and others that are working in jails and prisons and afterwards. But I'm thinking that I know you also, you know, spend a lot of time on, pro-social behavior. And so if we want to solve problems further upstream, that seems like we need to get into kind of community programs where maybe crime is more prevalent. And I thought we probably could start out by talking a bit about that today, because obviously we've had a couple of urban areas in our country that have really seen some unrest. Just say a little bit about what's happening in the in the urban communities or wherever where crime seems to be, one of the hot buttons.
Yeah. Those of us that are believers, those of us that really practice our faith and, you know, we have these church communities that we're a part of, we find that there are these networks of social support that are in these congregations that are really helpful to people. But there are still a lot of people out there that face all kinds of obstacles in their life, and they're not connected to these church communities. And for people like this, there's despair. I mean, that's the bottom line. There's despair and hopelessness. And I think that, you know, that's a toxic recipe if you look at people that, you know, they're unemployed. And they don't have the hope that they'll even be able to get married someday. And you start, you know, adding up all of these factors, and it makes things really difficult. This is why the faith factor is so important. And in those very communities that you're talking about where we're seeing unrest, it is the church in those inner city places that really kind of is holding things together. We don't talk about it, but the African American church is critical has been critical for years. Not all churches are important, but especially the African American church in these inner cities is critical to helping with pro-social behavior. You know, pro-social behavior is, you know, why do people do so many good things? Why are the vast majority of people poor as well as middle class? Why do most of them obey law? And most of them do. And they obey the law because they believe it's the right thing to do. And, you know, we don't hear a lot about pro-social behavior, even though the vast majority of behavior is positive. We hear about, of course, just the other part. So I think there's so much good work that's going on in these communities. But at times what happens is, you know, one event can be a trigger for another event, and then take people that, you know, their lives are comprised of hopelessness and despair, and then you've got a toxic recipe that can just go up in flames. And you know, these are serious situations that you're talking about. I haven't been able to get access to the internet very well, so I didn't even know about the Baltimore situation. It breaks my heart to hear about it. But, you know, this is where we need the members of the faith community from across the country to be, you know, intervening on behalf of that situation.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, about the church and the spiritual life of a community. Also talk about, you know, those that come to faith while in jail. And we'll talk about the volunteers who are doing such good work, trying to make a difference in our criminal justice system. We're talking about the book More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. It's a substantial book. It's got great research in it. And it'd be something if you're involved in ministries with youth, you're involved in maybe a prison, jail ministry, this would be a great resource to have as something for your pastor and church team as well. 877-933-2484 is our phone number. If you'd like to be in a drawing for that, we've got four copies of the book to give away. It's 877-933-2484. And if you have a question or a comment or a perspective you'd like to share with us, join us as we talk more with Byron Johnson, who directs the Institute for Studies of Religion and he's a distinguished professor of social sciences at the Baylor University, author of the book More God, Less Crime. More in a moment. Influence of grace, but God at work in the criminal justice system, thanks to men and women who care about being the hands and feet of Jesus in this particular area. In the book More God, Less Crime, a renowned criminologist and researcher, Professor Byron Johnson, proves that faith can be a powerful antidote to crime. And the book describes how faith communities, congregations, and faith-based organizations are essential in forming partnerships necessary to provide the human and spiritual capital to effectively address crime, offer rehabilitation, and the substantial aftercare problems facing former prisoners. We're talking with Byron today about it. And Byron, I'm just interested in just following up more on, by the way, we do have some copies of his book to give away. It's 877-93-FAITH. If you'd like to sign up for that and join the conversation as well, we'd welcome that. You know, we're talking about the influence of the churches in our community. One of the questions you ask in the book is that, you know, maybe research should ask this question, you know, why is it that people do not commit crime? And I think we kind of gets to the heart of the matter. I think we all know, at least from a faith perspective, that we all are born in sin and we, you know, but for the grace of God could be in some of these other shoes. But I'm interested in getting your perspective as the maybe church affiliation sort of gets lower and interest maybe in and attending church drops, you know, globally, or at least in North America. What does that mean for maybe future strategies for the church really being the salt and light in a community?
Well, you know, I think I have a little bit of good news for you there. there's a lot of media coverage right now on the decline of religion in America, the decline in church attendance. And the good news is that it's all a hoax. There really isn't a decline. And in fact, we have a conference on May the 3rd that we're putting on called the End of Religion question mark, where we're going to be debunking the myth that's been perpetrated on the American public. And every time a study comes out on religion, certain outlets will try to cover that in a way to paint a picture that people don't go to church anymore, that people are losing their faith, that atheism is on the rise. All of these things are inaccurate. You know, America is a very religious country. I think everyone at least would pretty much agree with that. But what's happened is people are less likely to attend, for example, a denomination that they may have been raised in. And so let's just say you were raised Baptist, but now you go to a non-denominational church. Or you were raised Catholic, and now you become a Protestant. It doesn't really matter. It's what we call switching. And in America, we have a lot of switching going on. People go from one place to another. Some would say that's a concern. I would say it's people shopping around. And where they get the best products, that's where they'll tend to park. And so the number for atheism in America is 4%, and it's been 4% for 70 years. As long as we've been monitoring it with survey data, that figure has not budged. People are slightly less likely to say that they attend now than they used to, slightly. But again, that's a tricky figure because it doesn't mean that people are not affiliated. Some people, like my mom, are not able to attend right now, even though she watches religious broadcasts most hours of the day. So there are some factors that preclude people from attending, and then people sometimes on surveys don't find their church, and they put down their no religion, and that's interpreted that people aren't attending. It's not true, Neil. So church attendance is still strong, remaining strong. And people are not abandoning their faith. I think sometimes, you know, it's the old thing where if we say it long enough and hard enough, people will believe it's true. And there's a sense in which people want to think there's a falling away from faith. But it's, you know, 90 to 95% of the people in America believe in God. They pray. And it's been this way for many, many years. And so I think people, there are those out there that are hopeful that America is becoming less religious. And I'm not even trying to argue that we're not, that America is not secular. Of course, we have a society that is very secular, but it doesn't mean that the church is falling away. And if the church were falling away, we really would need to be sounding the alarms, because that means less and less people to bring this social capital that we so desperately need in our country. But again, sometimes what you hear in the media is not exactly what's happening out there.
Good perspective. So maybe you can give us some perspective too on just the amount of crime. I mean, I think that always makes news. Especially dramatic stories, but probably the racial component of that as well. I mean, when we get into mm-hmm. talking about incarceration, I mean, there is a factor mm-hmm. there. But say a little bit about maybe just some general factors about crime in America.
Sure. You know, the crime rate in America has been pretty much stable for several decades now. You may hear it that crime is on the increase, and there are these periodic cycles where, you know, a community may have an unusual number of homicides this particular year. And then the next year it may go down. But in general, if you look at American crime, it's been flat and in some cases a slight decline over the last several decades. Now, the prison population, however, from about the 1980s onward, has been increasing dramatically. And so even though the crime rate has been stable, we've been incarcerating. So the laws have been tougher. I mean, we've all heard this, you know, the get tough on crime approach in the 80s and 90s. We did do that, and we did a an effective job of locking up people. The problem is we locked up an awful lot of people, and in many cases for an awful long time. And what happens, you can argue that in and of itself is somewhat of a deterrent, but it creates all kinds of issues. For one, it separates people, prisoners from their families. That doesn't help our communities a whole lot. So you have a generation or two that are being raised without their fathers. That's a real problem. But interestingly enough, the cost of incarcerating someone into their 70s and 80s becomes very expensive. And so now states are figuring the dollars and cents on this don't add up. You cannot build yourself out of a crime problem. And so this idea that we could lock up these offenders, just build more prisons, and our problems will be solved, we're now finding out after several decades this is a bad idea. And people on the left and the right, I've never seen anything like it, have come together to say we really do need reform. What does that reform look like? And that's why, at the outset, when you were asking that first question, I was saying this is a unique time that we're living in because states really are needing to come up with solutions. The problem is most solutions cost money. And that's why I think the faith community, as much heavy lifting as they have been doing, we need to do more because there's an opportunity now for the faith community to step up. And so many of the programs that I see, and I can talk to you about some of those exciting programs, they're privately funded, they're faith-based, and they're effective. And government leaders are wanting to hear more about them. And I think that the innovation that comes from communities of faith is really an encouraging kind of a thing, and gives me hope that, even though we live in difficult times, we may be on the verge of some real great progress, too.
Well, we'll look forward to getting a few of those stories of examples where faith-based ministries, men and women of faith, churches and organizations are having a positive impact and making a difference and keeping behavior moving in the right direction, holding communities together and caring about people that have been involved in crime or incarcerated. We'll get more with Byron Johnson, who is a distinguished professor of social sciences at Baylor University and the founding director of the Baylor Institute for the Study of Religion, as well as the director of the Program on Pro-Social Behavior. He's a senior fellow at the Witherspoon Institute and a senior research scholar. He's got great wisdom for us. He's written an insightful book called More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. And we'll talk more with Byron in just a couple of minutes. Welcome your calls as well. Got some copies of the book to give away, and you can sign up for that and share a question with us. 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH.
Jesus is the answer.
Two past the hour, and important word of truth there from the late Andre Crouch. We talked today about More God, Less Crime, talking why faith matters and how it could matter more. That's the title of a book written here a couple of years ago from Byron Johnson, who is a noted criminologist and researcher. He's a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University and founding director of the Baylor Institute for Studies of Religion, ISR, and you may see reports from them from time to time and some insightful research they're doing. He also directs the program on pro-social behavior. And the book, More God, Less Crime, has a number of stories and illustrations, sort of real stories and illustrations of churches and ministries working together with corrections people and police to make a difference. And Byron's just thinking maybe you could just share an example or two. I mean, we're talking about, how do communities really of, maintain a strong moral fabric, but you've seen examples in several cases.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you about one that's happening right now. We're about 2 years into a five-year study of a prison in Louisiana. This is called, it's the Louisiana State Penitentiary, also called Angola. And a warden went there 20 years ago, and this is a prison that's been known as the most violent prison in America, where fatalities are just an average thing in the prison. Corruption was rampant, and a warden went there 20 years ago by the name of Burl Cain and started a Bible college in the prison. And that had never been done before. This is a maximum security prison, and maximum security prisons are usually smaller. This prison has over 6,000 prisoners, making it perhaps the largest prison in America, maximum security. And here's the kicker. Most of the people there are serving life sentences without parole. Started a Bible college, and now fast forward 20 years later, and that prison looks so different than the prison he inherited 20 years ago. And so we were able to get a grant to do a major study there. We have a research team of five people investigating what's happened, because suicides, which used to be very common, homicide, very common, those aren't happening. They haven't been happening. And so what is happening there? Has the Bible college changed the prison? Well, if you go down there and take a look at it, and a lot of people have, people that you would know, for example, Bill Hybels and Will Creek and Billy Graham. I mean, many, many church leaders have been there to see firsthand what's happening. But we're the first to do a major study. And the seminary, so talk about the community involvement, the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary is providing the instruction for these guys. They're being trained as ministers, and then they start churches in the prison. So they have close to 30 churches with an entire pastoral staff. So the prisoners have their own churches, their own staff, and ministries. This is beyond the jobs that they have in the prison. They're required to work. They have ministries. You know, they help and mentor others. They have a hospice unit. It's this amazing thing that's happening there, where guys who have life sentence with no hope for parole are basically helping their brothers in prison to find God. And it's a remarkable thing. I've been doing research in prisons now for 30 years, and I've never seen anything quite like this. And so it's this Bible college that's preparing these inmates to be ministers and then unleashing them to do the work they feel like they're called to do in the prison. And now they're sending out ministers to other prisons as missionaries. And so, you know, to an outsider, you know, especially a skeptical person, they would say, well, you know, but you know, there's a motivation here. And I'm thinking, what's the motivation? They're not getting out. And it's just that these guys have been transformed, and now they want to serve others. So it's a very interesting, exciting project for us to get a chance to study. We're writing a book on the project, and we've already got a number of papers under review at journals. But we really want other states to understand what's happening in this prison, because I think that there are some incredible ideas that could be replicated in other prisons. So that's one of the stories, Neil, that I wanted to tell you about.
Well, let me just kind of, you know, talk as we're talking about the prison and the coming to faith, because I know that you address in your book, More God, Less Crime, that, you know, so-called jailhouse conversions aren't necessarily enough to keep one from going back to prison. It's one thing if you, I guess, are life sentence, you're in prison, but getting out. And it just reminds us, I guess, that as the church and caring community, we need to be, there's a key role to play there, isn't it, in helping those that come out of prison.
Yeah, let me tell you about a program that we've studied since you and I last talked. It's called the Prison Entrepreneurship Program, and people can go online to read about it. The website is pep.org. This is where business executives, believers, go into prison, find entrepreneurial inmates, and they begin to work with them and mentor them, in many cases disciple them, help them create business plans, and then they take these guys and stick with them when they get on the outside. And this is perhaps one of the most successful and innovative programs that I have had the chance to study. And it's very exciting because the guys that are coming out of prison, if you can imagine, you know, we have an unemployment problem in America, but these guys are coming out and virtually all of them are getting jobs. These are convicted felons. So the unemployment rate in this program is based in Houston. The unemployment rate in Houston is dramatically higher for the regular population than it is for felons that are coming out and participating in this program, because these guys have a mentor that's helping them become very savvy with business. And then, you know, they're contributing, they're paying taxes now. They're paying, if they're behind on child support, let's say, they're paying child support, and in many cases being reunited to their families. And this again, and business schools from a number of universities across the country have rallied behind this program, both faith-based and secular. So a number of the Ivy League schools are literally participating with the prison entrepreneurship program, and they're basically scoring these business plans that are put together by prisoners. So this also is a very innovative approach thought of by devout Christians that's having a major impact on our system.
You know, I'm wondering, are we maybe reaping the results of years of incarcerating so many people, and particularly it seems like young black men who now have really no place in society? I mean, fathers are fatherlessness has become a big issue, particularly in some of the urban communities. I mean, that we maybe brought some of this on ourselves, right? And we're seeing the fruit of it, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a chance to interview a young black male raised in poverty, a father in prison, many of them, their outlook doesn't look good, and they know it. And so this is very tragic. We did a study in Philadelphia where we talked to these guys, and none of them thought that they would be alive to see the age of 25. That's why we did one of these projects, Alive at 25, because many of them, didn't feel like they would be alive. They knew they would be caught up in the gang life, and it would be a brutal life, and they probably wouldn't live. And this is a very sad kind of a thing. And here again, the church is key. For young black males that go to church and are raised in the church and stay in the church, it's their ticket. They can make it in spite of all of the odds. And this is why the church is so critical, and it's why we really need to do everything we can do, of course, to encourage communities of faith. And rather than them being the target, which they sometimes are on moral issues, because they hold to traditional values. And so sometimes, if you want to take pot shots, you take pot shots at people of faith, when in fact it's these faith communities, again, that are doing so much of the good work that others are reluctant to do.
I think in the book you have examples of, some churches, faith-based organizations that were working, in the communities to help mentor these young men and women, kind of keep them out of gangs, those things. Talk about just what you're seeing there, maybe some hopeful signs.
Sure. Well, we all know naturally that mentoring is a good thing, and we have good data now showing that mentoring can really help people. And churches have responded. We can do more, though. I think that we can be much more intentional about recruiting mentors within our churches to come alongside young kids who really need that kind of a figure in their life. But let me give you another interesting thing about this whole mentoring piece. We're doing a drug study in Akron and Cleveland, Ohio. And this is for young teens or teenagers that are becoming young adults that are addicted to alcohol or drugs, and they've been court-ordered into treatment. And what we're finding is if they get connected to God while they're in treatment, it is a huge help to them. But that's only part of it. if they are then, if they help other drug addicts and the service component, if they follow through with that, then they're going to stay sober. So you find God and you help others. So in other words, you're providing mentoring to your other brothers or sisters that are struggling with drugs. It actually helps the person doing the mentoring stay sober. And you know, so in the Bible, when it says it's better to give than to receive, yes, it's important to receive. And, you know, mentees benefit from being, you know, mentored. But people that are doing the mentoring, they themselves benefit in profound ways because it helps us become less selfish and less narcissistic. And so that's why it's so important to reach out and help, because so many of these kids that are struggling right now, and those numbers are not exaggerated. They are, the drug and alcohol problems among our young in America have been going up steadily for years now, and we have a really big problem. And then they become isolated, and so they become narcissistic, and that's why they need to be connected to other people. And once they get connected to other people, it helps others and it helps themselves. And so that new research is really beginning to help us understand a little bit more about why mentoring is so important all the way around for people that are being mentored as well as the people. So this is why the church needs it. We need to help others because we're called to do it. And in turn, God blesses those people for doing it.
Good insight today from Byron Johnson, who is a noted researcher, criminologist, author of the book More God, Less Crime. He leads the Baylor Institute for Studies on Religion, as well as directs their program on pro-social behavior, and he's a distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University. Joining us today, we're going to continue in a minute. We do have some copies of his book, More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More. You're welcome to sign up for a copy of that. We'll do a drawing here at the end of the show and continue on our conversation. We'll talk a little bit about, you know, those the important role that volunteers play in this, but also the need to see partnerships in making a dent, making an impact on keeping our community strong and reducing crime, and talk about the great work of faith-based ministries. We'll get more on that with Byron Johnson in just a moment. Stay tuned. Today, why faith matters and how it could matter more when it comes to issues of criminal justice system. Talking about the book More God, Less Crime, written by Byron Johnson. It's based on some interesting and thoughtful research that he continues to do as the founding director of the Baylor Institute for Studies on Religion, or of Religion, I should say, ISR. He directs their program on pro-social behavior. He's a distinguished professor of social sciences at Baylor University, and serves on a number of centers as a senior research scholars and the like. Happy to have him with us today. Pam from Eldora, Iowa, called in and said, I agree with everything that's being said. She said, if we don't get God and a basic moral value system in people when they're young, they're going to end up pursuing crime. And she saw it firsthand working in a state training school for boys. Frank had said many of the harm and miscommunication that's been caused by the internet and lack of information is that that can be a source of antisocial behavior. I'm sure you can see examples of both of those.
Yeah.
Byron, let me ask you, you talked about the importance of mentoring and the value to mentees and mentors, but I'm wondering, you know, can we expect to rely on volunteers and people of goodwill to kind of carry the load for whether it's mentoring or pro-social activities? I mean, is that enough if it's just the church stepping up?
No, it's not enough. You know, I think every now and again you'll hear someone from, you know, some church say that, you know, the church can fix everything. It's too much to ask. Churches, I think, do so much now. I do think that they can probably do more. These are remarkably resilient people, and with great gifts, great talents. and some of those are still untapped. But I think what we really do need are a series of partnerships, and sometimes people in the faith community don't play too well with each other. That's one issue. We need to do a better job of ministries working one with another. But I really believe that we need public-private partnerships, which will make us all uncomfortable, and I think that we need partnerships with government. Government certainly can't fix our problems. I think most of us would agree with that. But I think it's wrong to think that the churches are going to correct America's social problems. They've shown that they can really do a lot of good work. But I think churches can do more in partnership with other groups. And by partnering with government, as we're now beginning to see, as these experiments that I'm talking to you about are largely the result of the government being willing to partner. And that partnership can be very powerful because the government brings some things too. You know, you can't just do any program without having some accountability and oversight, and the government can provide that. And but then faith community can bring a lot to the table. And then what happens when you get the government working with the faith community, and then the faith community shows that they can be effective? Now you've got an ally, and you've also brought light into a place that needs light and salt. And so that's why I think these partnerships can be very, very strategic. We're beginning to see that now. And so I think that the churches will be able to multiply their efforts as they partner. So everything that I've talked about today, the PEP program, the prison entrepreneurship program, the faith-based programs like Prison Fellowship and Kairos and so many more, and then this last thing of, you know, having a seminary or Bible college, someone's going to foot that bill, and it's not the state. This is all privately funded, but it's in cooperation with the state. And so it's these kinds of partnerships that I think will allow us to begin to make a dent in some of these areas, and who knows what kinds of reforms around the corner that we might be able to think of that could be good alternatives. But for me, Neil, it's all about these partnerships. How can we work together? What can we learn from others? And I think when we do that, that's really answering the call of the gospel. And I think that's where all the good work can lead to positive results.
Patty, call in, listening to Faith 1090, and just want to ask if you'd speak a little bit more about some of the transitional programs for prisoners. I mean, we just, you know, recidivism is one of the, you know, the big concerns. So just say a word about the needs there.
Yeah, well, what happens, so for guys coming out of prison, what, you know, some people think, you know, I'm just so upset. These people get out of prison and they go right back. The recidivism rate is so high. The recidivism rate is high, but when you consider coming out of prison, you don't have a driver's license. Let's just say that you've been locked up for 5 years and it wasn't good when you were at home before, and they're not so thrilled you're coming back. Believe it or not, I guess people think that, you know, families come and they pick them up and it's just a big parade for them going home. Many of these guys come out of prison, there's no one there to pick them up. They have a $50 $50 given to them, let's say, and then a ticket for a bus. They take a Greyhound bus home. There's no one there to greet them. Many of them don't even have a good housing situation. So if you think about it, okay, no driver's license, no housing, I've got to get back to my community, and I've got to get a job, because if I don't get a job, I'm going to be in violation of my parole. But how am I going to get to work if I do get a job, because I don't have any transportation? You start thinking about these basic kinds of things that are really problematic for someone coming out of prison. And they're going to start applying for positions, and applications are going to ask them if they have a felony. And they're going to have to say yes. So I've talked to so many inmates that said, you know, Byron, I'm a Christian now. I can't be dishonest. I need to say what's happened, but who's going to want to hire a convicted felon? And some states now are beginning to change that, too. They're taking away the requirement to put down there that you've committed a felony. And the reason there is it hurts them from getting jobs. These guys that have paid their price to society, they've been locked up, and now it shouldn't be held against them. They're trying to make good on this second chance that they're getting, the second lease on life. And so these are just some of the hurdles that these guys face. Some of them have been, you know, let's say their family does take them back, but, you know, they've been gone for 5 years and the kids have grown up while this guy was in prison. So just coming back home isn't going to be the easiest transition. But, you know, this guy's become a believer while he's locked up. And so he's matured in his faith and, you know, he wants to be reconciled to his family. These are all important, critical things that have to happen. I mean, everyday people struggle in life, but they don't have the obstacles that so many of these guys face. That's why the transition period that you just indicated is so critical. It's difficult. And, you know, people of faith are making a difference there, just like the one program that I mentioned, PEP, Prison Entrepreneurship Program, but other programs like this too, helping out with, you know, faith-based halfway houses, for example. And they're all over the place. And that's so key because these guys don't want to go back to prison. Some people may think that that's a desire, but it isn't. They really do want to make it. But this is why we need to help them through that critical first, second, and third year. You know, the research shows if they can stay out of prison for 3 years, then there's a very good chance they're going to make it. But it's that initial year especially that's so critical because their life can kind of fall apart for them really quick. That's why, of course, having a mentor, someone that, you know, started coming in to see them while they were in prison and they stuck with them on the outside, just that one mentor may be the difference between whether or not they make it or come back.
We're pretty good about sort of not in my backyard, don't want a, you know, halfway house in our neighborhood or
yeah.
those things. But to really show the love of Christ can go a long way, especially in these as you say, these early months when they're just getting out, and to really put some hands and feet of Jesus there goes a long way. We got just a minute or so left, Byron. Wondering if you mentioned the entrepreneurship program out of Houston, pep.org, P-E-P.org, but are there other places where we could look if, you know, if God's sort of speaking to us today about maybe there's some ways we could be involved more fully?
Sure. I mean, you know, Prison Fellowship, of course, I've been working with them for so many years. They're doing such great things, and they're now very close to watching this Angola prison that I was telling you about. And so a number of states now are starting Bible colleges in prisons, trying to follow the lead of that prison in Louisiana. And so Prison Fellowship, of course, I would always recommend that people, you know, volunteer there. They have so many good programs. And, you know, of course, everybody's heard of Angel Tree, which is kind of their signature program. And they work with churches all across the country. So that's a great one. Kairos is another fabulous prison ministry that's been out there and active for just so many years. And these are just a couple. But I think what people would want to do is to go online or pull up the telephone directory and look for these groups that are right there in their own community. They don't have to start anything. They can get plugged in already. I'm a big brother with big brothers and big sisters. It's a secular organization, but I just believe it's important to even work in areas like that. So I've been a big for a long time, and just things like that where we can make a difference. It may seem as if it's small, but I think in God's math, it's big.
Hmm. Good words, some encouraging words, and some opportunities for advanced ministry impact. Byron Johnson, who is a distinguished professor of social sciences at Baylor University and the founding director of the Baylor Institute for Studies of Religion, the ISR, and he's a researcher, a noted criminologist. He's authored the book More God, Less Crime, Why Faith Matters and How It Could Matter More, and giving us some good recommendations today. Byron, great to visit with you. Thanks so much for carving out some time.
Bet, Neil. Thank you.